before, and without any further ado, I'd like to move on to today's subject. The title is, I hope, reasonably challenging for our speakers. The Russia Enigma, Challenging the West? So I hope we'll get a variety of views and see where we go with that. We have three very eminent speakers. On my right, Sir Tony Brenton, who was formerly British ambassador in Russia, and that was, I think, between 2004 and 2007? 2008. It was a year short. Very interesting time in Russian history. It was a very turbulent time. He's also became a fellow of Wolfson College, and he's on the governing body of that. So delighted to have him here today to speak to us from his very personal knowledge of Russia and where Russia is going. Secondly, on my far left, Dr. Samuel Green, who is the director of the Russia Institute at King's College London and a senior lecturer in Russian politics. He's an expert in Russian politics and social movements and the link between Russian domestic and foreign policy. He's written a lot about this. His book, which was published in 2014, was entitled Moscow in Movement, Power and Opposition in Putin's Russia. So again, I think we will hear from him a great deal of knowledge. And last, certainly but not least, in the order today, Charles Clover, who writes from Beijing for the Financial Times. Between 2008 and 2013, he was the Financial Times Moscow bureau chief. He's been with the Financial Times since 1997. He's the author of a book called Black Wind, White Snow, The Rise of Russia's New Nationalism, which has literally just been published by Yale University Press, and which is on sale at the back of the room if you're interested, at a price of £20. And I'm sure if you buy one, he'll be delighted to sign them for you at the end of the meeting. But without any further ado, I'm going to ask Tony Brenton to speak to us for about 10 minutes, and then the others, and then I'll open it up as usual to questions and comments from the floor. Tony.
Thank you, Michael. Okay, good afternoon, everyone. I guess it's either a sign by which I should be deeply encouraged or deeply discouraged that so many people are still willing to turn out to talk about Russia in these days when there's so much else going on. And I should warn you that various members of the audience have already incited me to be controversial, which those of you who know my views on all of this will have no doubt I fully intend to be. And I'm going to set out a set of propositions, really, about Russia. The most obvious first one of which is that there's sort of a certain air of fatalism has now entered Western relations with Russia. There's a sort of presumption that we're on the way towards what has been rather loosely dubbed a new Cold War, that relations are going to be pretty chilly for a long time to come, and that there's going to be a degree of military, political, what have you, competition, tension, confrontation in the relationship, again, for a long time to come. Now, this view of the way things are going, as I said, has become pretty common, and I don't think people have really reflected on the implications of that. If you think back to the last Cold War, you are thinking back to 40 years of really quite serious, dangerous, and costly confrontation, with the odd, unnerving descent to pretty close to a nuclear exchange. So I think before we abandon ourselves to the new Cold War, we should ask ourselves a little bit whether there's anything we can do about it. First proposition. Second proposition. This change in atmosphere is, of course, pretty recent. If you think back to the halcyon days of the end of 2013, you think back to a period when Russia's relations with the West were awkward in various ways, but on the whole, things felt as if they were going in the right direction. Trade was going up. Expenditure on military competition was actually going down. We contained such political tensions as existed. We didn't much like the Putin regime, but were content to live with it. And the expectation was that with growing trade, with growing interactions in other ways, with growing people movements between the two sides, sooner or later, the same factor which brought down nasty dictatorships in other parts of the world, with growing prosperity, growing links with the West, growing appreciation of Western values, would also eventually begin to operate in Russia. Now, that expectation about Russia, that may be over-optimistic, but it didn't feel entirely unrealistic at the time, expectation about Russia, was, of course, turned around really quite dramatically by events in Ukraine beginning at the beginning of 2014. Now, I'm not going to go into the detail of all of these, but I think it's worth noting that there are two very different narratives about what happened in Ukraine. There is our, the Western narrative. The Russians went in there, broke international law, broke all sorts of political and other commitments to the Ukrainian administration, seized a patch of land in a way that no patch of land has been seized since 1945. It's worth noting that Obama, I think yesterday, repeated a mistake committed by all senior Western politicians at the moment, who talk about no changes of borders as a result of the use of force since 1945. That's wrong. We changed the borders of Serbia at the end of the 1990s by use of force. But it's undoubtedly the case that Russia's seizure and annexation of Crimea is new and worrying, and generated a feeling among us in the West that we're dealing with a different Russia, a revanchist Russia, a Russia which, having gotten away with this, if they do, will then go out and do it again in all sorts of other places. The Russian perception, it's worth saying, is entirely different. Their memory is of a succession of regimes around the world brought down with Western enthusiasm and by Western action. They point to Libya. They point to Iraq. They point to Egypt, actually, where Mubarak was eased out as a result of our acquiescence. And they look at what happened in Ukraine as us bringing down another regime, Yanukovych, in the country which they regard as absolutely closest to themselves. Now, the Ukrainians may not share that view, but that's very much the Russian view. And at that point, the line coming out of Russia and believed by the vast majority of Russians is this has to stop. We cannot let the West carry on in this cheerful way, kicking out regimes with whom we're friends. And that is the background to where they are. They view what they did in Ukraine partly as a result of panic, as they saw the West dangerously taking over Ukraine. Putin referred to the nightmare of NATO troops in Sevastopol kicking out the Russian fleet from there. But their picture, therefore, is actually of Western aggression, and of the Russian action as being in response to that aggression, and the change of borders by force, of course, following on from the Kosovo precedent. So two very different narratives about what happened in Ukraine. And then Syria has come on top of that, where, and I'll come back to Syria, where our view is that the Russians are backing a nasty dictator, which they undoubtedly are. The Russian view is that we're just completely naive, and without this nasty dictator, we'd have an Islamist Syria, which I suspect is also the case. So, huge difference in narrative between the two sides, and really quite difficult to bridge between them. And therefore, come back to the question, if we do see the world so differently, are we in fact landed with the new Cold War that we now seem to be heading towards? First point to make is that it wouldn't be a new Cold War on the model of the old Cold War. The difference in size between the two competitors is much, much greater, of course, now than it was at the time of the old Cold War. And the other point about the new Cold War, if that is what it is to be, is that the ideological component is much, much weaker, if there at all. We were dealing with communist, expansionist Soviet Union back then. We're now dealing with corrupt, no doubt, authoritarian, no doubt, but not ideologically hostile to the West in any real sense, Russia. The difference in scale, it's worth noting, is not necessarily an encouraging feature of the conflict, if that's what's coming. The parallel here is between Pakistan and India, another military confrontation, where the small side, because he knows very well that he's outmatched in conventional arms, in the sense that he would lose any conventional war very, very quickly. And the parallel with Russia is very, very clear. They know that they're massively outgun. And Putin has been talking, of course, over the last few months about the Russian nuclear deterrent and option. So the difference in scale is not entirely encouraging. And it's worth underlining how big the difference in scale is. NATO has 6 times Russia's population, 10 times its defence expenditure, and about 20 times its GDP. The border separating NATO from Russia, it depends how you calculate it, but roughly speaking, has moved 500 miles closer to Moscow since 1989. So as you ask yourself about the relationship between these two sides, I would argue that the revanchist, threatening, challenging Russia out there is a figment of, in a sense, the Western military imagination. And there's a great quotation which captures this. The great Lord Salisbury, back at the end of the 19th century, said, "If you believe the doctors, nothing is wholesome. If you believe the theologians, nothing is innocent. If you believe the military, nothing is secure." And I think what we're looking at now is a Western military who, even though we outmatch the Russians in every conceivable way, still are offering arguments for our insecurity. In reality, Russia is on the defensive. If you ask yourself the question, the guys sitting in the Kremlin, knowing the disparity of forces between us, are they seriously going to destabilise Estonia with a view to occupying it? Are they seriously going to go out there and launch a war which could turn into a war with NATO? Some people say, well, that'll boost their domestic popularity. I cannot think of anything better calculated to destroy the Putin regime than launching an unsuccessful war with NATO. So if I can leave you with one thought at the end of today, it is that the revanchist Russia, so widely advertised in the Western press, is, as I say, a figment of the security and the wider Western political and analytical imagination. So what can we do to try and avoid the threat of new Cold War as it, given the problems that it contains for us? Quite a lot of people in the West have said, well, Putin's corrupt, Putin's running an increasingly narrow authoritarian regime, he has economic problems, we just wait for him to fall. We could be waiting a very long time, I'm afraid. Mr. Putin, partly as a result of what's happened, but it is actually continuous throughout his period as president, enjoys enormous support among the Russian people. That support has not noticeably suffered as a result of the economic problems, although it could, of course, be eroded. And indeed, we in the West have helped to bolster him because the Russian instinct, when they see themselves as being threatened and challenged from outside, is to gather around their state and their head of state. And what we have seen since the beginning of the Ukrainian crisis is actually a huge increase in Putin's popularity and standing. He's feeling a bit nervous. He's just reorganised his security arrangements and so on. He has elections coming up at the end of this year. He has really much more serious elections in 2018. But my instinct is, especially if the economic collapse bottoms out and begins to recover, which is what people are now expecting, is that he can see himself through those. And the final point I would make about the attractive prospect in many eyes of Putin disappearing is that even if he did, if you ask yourself what you would get as a replacement, you need a man who is in with security agencies, in with the state industries, acceptable to the largely nationalist right-wing Russian public opinion. What you get is a Putin clone. So be careful what you wish for. And I think, again, another takeaway for you. Our problem is not with Putin. Our problem is with Russia. Putin, as he acts and behaves, okay, there is a Putin agenda. He wants to stay in power. But there's also a very big Russian agenda there. So I would argue you have a Russia which is insecure, feels threatened, ain't going to budge from policies, roughly speaking, along the lines that it is pursuing. And I would argue, too, that we, the West, the vastly preponderant side in this argument, it is for us to do what we can to try and regenerate trust and understanding and back away from what, as I say, looks increasingly like an inevitable new Cold War. And there are a whole bunch of things which, to some extent, we are beginning to do a bit under the carpet, which it seems to me, and this might not work. We may already have got ourselves locked into such intransigent positions that the decline into deeper confrontation may be unavoidable. But I would argue that it is worth trying. And the obvious things to do are, first of all, to strengthen communications. A thing called the NATO-Russia Council, which is one of the balmier bits of our sanctions package, which of course hasn't worked, was to close down the NATO-Russia link. And NATO has finally, last week, found a way of reopening that channel. We need to be reopening more channels like that, not least because, at the moment, we have fewer military-to-military contacts with Russia as a result of our own cutting off links than we had at the height of the Cold War. There are dangerous things going on out there in the Baltics and elsewhere. We need to be able to talk to each other to prevent and to deal with any accidents that might occur. So reopening links, which has begun with the NATO-Russia Council, is a obvious first step. Secondly, Syria. Now, I'm not going to go into a huge amount of detail about this. I described the differences that the Russians are backing Assad and we hate Assad. But actually, the reality on the ground is that the people we purport to be backing, the so-called moderate opposition, we won't even supply them with certain arms because we've mistrusted them so deeply. They are, this is the Pentagon's word, intermingled with Al-Qaeda and worse. These are not guys who we want to take over Syria unless under very strong adult supervision, if I could put it that way. And it's going to take time to set that up. And Assad is what provides us with the scope to bridge the gap until we've got something we can be confident in Syria. That's exactly the Russian view of the situation. They know Assad is deeply dislikable, deeply problematic, ruler of Syria. But they fear deeply an Islamist Syria, not only because it's an ally of theirs, but because they have genuine Islamist problems at home. That David Cameron's concern that they were going out there to Syria, our young men going out there to Syria, training up, coming back, launching terrorist incidents back here, is paralleled exactly by things that Putin has said. We have a huge shared agenda in Syria. Western politicians have resisted admitting that there is that shared agenda, precisely because Russia is untouchable for all the other reasons. We need to begin to recognise that there are things we should be doing together there, and let's get on and do it. And I have to say, the US State Department is quietly acknowledging that, but in the teeth of, in particular, the attitude of the Pentagon. Am I going on too long? I'll give you a couple more minutes. So Syria, firstly. Now, firstly, contacts. Secondly, Syria. Thirdly, Ukraine. Now, one of the striking things about the meeting of the NATO-Russia Conference Council last week, they disagreed, of course. We send a diplomat off to something like that, you've got a clear position, you dislike the other guy, you tell him to give it to them in spades, and they did, both sides. But they did come out with one rather clear conclusion, which is that the only game in town for solving Syria is the so-called Minsk Agreement. And that reiteration is quite important. And if you look at the Minsk Agreement, I know bits of it, all sorts of bits of it aren't being observed. Neither side has complete control of what's going on the ground. Fighting rumbles along at a low level. But the key problem with the Minsk Agreement is the requirement on Ukraine to give an agreed level of autonomy to the Donbass. And Ukraine is simply not delivering on that. It doesn't even look as if it's trying to deliver on that because the domestic political problem's too great. So let's be clear. The problem with arriving or moving towards peace in Ukraine doesn't lie with Russia. Russia loves the Minsk Agreement. It gives them everything they want. Why would they get in the way? It lies with Ukraine. And we in the West need to be more honest and upfront about where the problem lies, and we need to begin applying serious pressure to the Ukrainians to deliver on the commitments they have made. And that may well include, I would argue, at some point moving towards beginning to lift sanctions on Russia, both because that adds to pressure on Ukraine, and because that gets us out of the rather awkward hole we're now in with regard to sanctions. They're not working. As with all sanctions regimes, we're stuck with it until we can find an excuse. Here's a rather good excuse for getting out of some of it. Okay, so there are various things out there. They're not going to solve the problem, but they would begin to help to re-establish the sort of trust which is necessary if we are going to avoid the new Cold War. The alternative, I remind you, looking back, is huge expense, remilitarization of Europe, a continent which up until 2013, militarization seemed like a bad past, and, as I said, the odd unnerving reference to the possibility of the use of nuclear war. I leave it to you to choose which you prefer. Thank you.
Thank you for an excellent start. I'm now going to call Dr. Samuel Green.
Thank you. It's a hard act to follow. Thank you, first of all, for being here, and thank you, Lord Loken, for the invitation to be here. And thanks in particular, actually, to Tony for finally, right at the end, giving me something that I can disagree with. It's unusual that we don't disagree on some things. But in particular, I'll get this out of the way and say something about Minsk before I say something about Russia, because I actually think that the Minsk Agreement is not a conflict resolution agreement. It's an agreement to avoid conflict resolution, and it lands Ukraine in the unenviable position of Moldova or of Georgia prior to 2008, and those might have been acceptable agreements to the Moldovans and the Georgians back in the early 90s when they didn't know that they were going to be stuck with those conflicts for 20 years or more down the road. I think that expecting Kiev under duress to accept an indefinite term of limited sovereignty over a significant portion of its territory and population is a bit much to ask any government to accept. Not that we haven't asked other governments to accept it in the past, but I can certainly see the reasons for Ukrainian reluctance there. About Russia, which is the fundamental issue here, Today, I would agree, actually, that there is an air of fatalism. I would agree that it's dangerous to get dragged into the paradigm of a new Cold War. I would disagree that it's the conventional wisdom. I think if I think through experts in the policy field or the academic world, those who actually would think that we are in a new Cold War are in the distinct minority. I can really only think of one who's made the argument forcefully and systematically. If I exclude sort of the some of the newspaper columnists and such. Not that there's anything wrong with newspaper columnists, but most, I think, people who spent a lot of time looking at this and who looked at Russia professionally and looked at and lived through the Cold War don't see a lot of parallels. I do usually spend a lot of time criticizing the Russian government. Most of what I do is look at Russian domestic politics, and so there's often a lot to criticize. But I thought today that I would spare some bile instead for the West and flip the coin, because I think Russia is a challenge, but I think Russia is a challenge to the West, and particular to Europe, because both have studiously avoided anything resembling a strategic approach to Russia. Maybe this presages the discussion to come about the international implications of half-baked foreign policies. But after the end of the Soviet Union, after the end of what we thought was going to be the end of the Cold War, after 1989 and 1991, I think that Western thinking about Russia, even in policy circles and to a certain extent in academic circles, was dominated by two worldviews that were firmly rooted in fantasy. The first was the fantasy of the end of history, right? The idea that left to its own devices, Russia having left the grips of state socialism and totalitarianism would eventually become like us, that the world was settling on a single common denominator of liberal democracy and free markets. Not that any of us can agree on what it means to be like us, even within Europe, to say nothing of the West and the world more broadly. But that, I think, was a dominant approach, particularly in Brussels and in a lot of member state capitals in the European Union, that assumed that there was a job to be done in helping those Central European states that wanted to join the European Union to move through their transformation, some more successfully than others, that taking on Russia in that kind of an arrangement would be more than Europe could handle. But that was not necessarily a problem, because there was really only one direction of travel in which Russia would go, and maybe there would be bumps along the road, but eventually it would get there. The second fantasy, I think, was the fantasy of Orientalism, which we hear a lot today, but which we've heard all along, that Russia will never be like us, right? That Russia has its own unique history, that Russia has its own unique culture, all of which is certainly true, but there's something about Russia. George W. Bush said this at some point after finding Putin's soul somewhere deep in his eyes, right? That there is something about Russia and Russians that will always tend towards a system of governance that is less than democratic. I think that's an equally dangerous fantasy. It allows us to wash our hands of it, to say that there is nothing in European behavior or Western behavior that's had any bearing on how Russia functions today and how Russia is governed, and thus there's nothing that we have done that has created the difficult relationship that we have at the moment. Turning to the reality and away from the fantasy for a moment, I think that there are a few things that we know fairly clearly. We see in Russia a deepening authoritarianism with increasing reliance on coercion and on hierarchy. Increasing reliance, I think, on these things mostly because of decreasing liquidity in the economy and an increasing sense among many people that the challenges of governing Russia, of making the economy function, of maintaining some distribution of wealth that keeps people happy, of making the infrastructure function and moving to the future, are only going to become more challenging in the next several years or decades than they have been in the past. The second is a growing alienation between rulers and ruled. We look at the economic situation in Russia. It is not a pleasant economic situation for most Russian citizens. We've, in the second year of recession, probably we'll move into a third. In the last year, we've had something like a 5 to 6% decrease in incomes, somewhat higher decrease in salaries as pensions and other state distribution have cushioned the decrease in incomes. And we've seen to a 9 to 10% decrease in consumption. Right? And yet we see, as Tony Brenton said earlier, we see resilient rates of popularity for Putin and for the Russian government more broadly. At the same time, if you ask Russian citizens, and the polls do this, do you think that the Russian government at any level is effective, from the federal level to the ministries, to regional government, to municipal government? Most people don't think much more of the effectiveness of government than people do here and in much of Europe. Right? We read about this and we hear about this in the popular discussion and the policy discussion among these people who are constantly waiting for Putin to evaporate, that this is a paradox that must eventually resolve itself. I would argue that it's not, that this is actually a stable equilibrium, and it's stable precisely because Russians have such a low expectation of their state. We hear about Russians as being paternalistic. We hear about Russians as expecting the state to do things for them. You might like the state to do things for you, but the entire experience of post-Soviet reality for Russians has been one of self-reliance, of not expecting, certainly not getting much from the state. And so the things that make the state popular are things that are ideational and ideological. They're things that are symbolic. There are things that actually may have more to do with foreign policy than they do with domestic policy. But if you are holding your breath waiting for the other shoe to drop in this relationship between economic performance and Putin's popularity, you are going to be waiting for a very long time. The third, however, is the economic reality that this is an economy with vanishingly few sources of growth. In the last 6 months, I can count about four or maybe five major economic conferences and forums that have been held in Russia, some degree of state involvement, all of which have been about where do we create growth in the Russian economy, all of which have come down to reducing red tape, structural reforms without specifying what those structural reforms are going to be. These conversations have been going on for as long as Putin has been president and even longer, and yet none of these things have happened, at least in the last decade or so. Where that's going to come from, obviously, is a problem that the Russians are going to have to solve on their own. We're not very good at coming up with sources of growth in many economies around the world, and it may be that Russia is falling into an unenviable combination of the resource curse on one hand and the middle-income trap on the other, in which middle-income countries around the world, after attaining a certain level of economic development, find it very difficult to maintain reasonable levels of growth. Obviously, recovering oil prices and lifting sanctions at some point would have a positive impact, but I would remind you that the Russian economy was headed into recession before Crimea and when oil prices were still closer to $100 a barrel. Add to this something that actually has been a constant in Russian policy, but that the West has only woken up to in the last couple of years, which is a strong preference in Moscow for what Europe calls the Eastern Neighborhood and what others might call the near abroad to be governed more or less the way Russia is, the way Ukraine has been to date, the way Moldova often is, the way much of the Caucasus is, the way Belarus is, and the way Central Asia is. In other words, with a certain kind of relationship between power and money, with a heavily monopolized and mercantilist economy that is built primarily around rent distribution, protected competitive positions, and all of the things that the European Union at least tries not to be. Right? So the question that Europe has to grapple with is how strong is Europe's countervailing preference for the Eastern neighborhood to be governed differently? Is it important to member states, to the European Union as a whole, that the states, the countries in between Russia and the European Union, begin over time gradually to be governed more in the way with a clearer separation of economic and political power, with more impersonalized institutions, with leveler playing fields for economic competition, that this become more the norm than the exception in the region. We had thought, because we weren't paying attention, that the geopolitical threat to Russia was to do with missile defense, was to do with NATO, was to do with the United States primarily, and that Europe, because Europe doesn't talk about itself in geopolitical terms, was a non-zero-sum game, right, was a win-win situation for everybody. It's a win-win situation if you happen to want to govern your state the way that Europe tends to govern its states. If you don't, right, it's a net loss. And as a result, we have a military conflict on the European continent that was sparked by a trade treaty. Because we were not paying attention to what was, I think, for a number of years, a very clear signal about the geopolitical threat of European expansion, not NATO expansion, that was coming out of Moscow. Right? Now, Europe could decide that it's content for its relationship with Russia to be like its relationship with China. It could decide, I'm wrapping up, that it's content for its relationship with Russia to be like its relationship with Saudi Arabia. Other countries that most Europeans would not want to live in because of the way that they are governed, right? But they are far enough away that their influence on their surrounding regions, right, are not of material interest, for the most part, to the European Union. Is Europe prepared to draw a border of that kind so close to its own heartland? In which case, we can have a pragmatic, almost orientalist relationship with Russia. If it is not, then we need to think about a strategy that involves both the transformation of Europe and Europe's relationship with Russia, but also the transformation of Russia itself, if we're going to avoid the kinds of a very real geopolitical conflict that we find in the Eastern neighborhood today. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So I feel like I should be defending newspaper columnists in my talk, and unfortunately I'm not. I'm going to blame newspaper columnists and public intellectuals for everything that has gone wrong with the U.S. Western Anglo-American Russian relationship. And I'm going to say that actually all of these real-world things that we've been discussing, like military budgets and GDPs and geopolitics, don't actually matter. And the only thing that matters is newspaper columnists. So I've written a book about the rise of nationalism in Russia. And a lot of I'm certainly in deference to Ambassador Brenton, I want to say that a lot of Western actions have fed Russia's sense of insecurity and created this kind of spiral of nationalism in Russia. And I've focused, but I want to say that I've focused my book on a dynamic that I've seen in country after country that I've been based in, from Iraq to Afghanistan to Russia to China, and that is the sort of the spiraling dynamic of nationalism, that nationalism becomes sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy. And I've seen this in Iraq, where Sunnis and Shias never really thought of themselves as Sunnis and Shias until suddenly an event happens and you know, overnight they discover this kind of elemental belonging to their confession, or Tajiks and Pashtuns in Afghanistan never really felt like, I mean, they all felt Afghan, and then suddenly overnight they suddenly decide that they belong to some elemental identity, and they start building you know, concrete walls around their neighborhoods and setting up checkpoints and militias. And I feel like this is something that is happening in Russia too, that this spiraling kind of nationalism has begun, and it is in full swing. And you're seeing this in Ukraine. East Ukraine, I was based in East Ukraine in the late 1990s. East Ukraine never had a problem being in Ukraine. East Ukraine in those days ran Ukraine, so they really didn't mind being part of Ukraine. You're starting to see this kind of inevitable logic of nationalism and antagonism developing throughout the region. And I'm going to blame for this, newspaper columnists. I'm going to blame my own ilk. I've written a history of fringe coffee house nationalists in Russia and how they made the transition from being guys who were sitting in their basements churning out blogs and pamphlets to being guys who have their own national TV shows or chairing departments at major universities, and how they effectively became mainstream, and not because they moved to the mainstream, but because the mainstream moved to them. And I think that is a process that needs to be explained. Now, I'm not saying that when I'm talking about nationalism, I'm not saying that Russia doesn't have a very proud history. It has a history that its people can be legitimately proud of standing up to invaders, of defeating fascism. There is a real history. It is a complicated history, but it is a legitimate history. What I'm talking about when I say nationalism is I'm talking about a kind of a fake history, a fake mythology that is being created and is being created now, and this is something that is having actually real-world effects. So you're seeing, this is the kind of the history that comes out of TV broadcasts and out of newspapers. And it is a history of national humiliation at the hands of the West, a history of foreign enemies and plots and conspiracies. It is a history of having claims on the territory of neighboring countries and lands that are not Russian, but that somehow historically belong to Russia and are an inalienable part of Russia's sense of identity, which I think is an artificial creation that is being created now. What I'm talking about when I say nationalism is creating and selling a fake history and unifying people around a fake history and a mythical history. And a lot of studies of nationalism focus on why people believe it. And I think that's actually not the right attitude, the right approach to take, because I mean, I would wager that Putin doesn't actually believe this. He uses words like Novorossiya, you know, Novorossiya, the Tsarist term for Eastern Ukraine. He uses words like Eurasia. He uses words like national traitor, sphere of influence. I would wager that he sees these things in sort of, you know, instrumental terms. He doesn't actually believe it, but he has a use for it. I would say that, you know, it's still nonetheless quite valuable to study what he's saying or what these intellectuals that are surrounding the regime in Russia are saying, in the same way that it's useful to study what a Donald Trump is saying, or you know, even somebody closer to home like Boris Johnson, who's talking about you know, arguments for Brexit. Do they really believe this, or are they using a kind of a nationalist fantasy to further their you know, political ambitions, and I would say that Putin is probably doing very much that when he talks about Russia's Eurasian destiny. I think belief is not actually the right category to put nationalism in. I mean, people agree with nationalism, people act on nationalism despite not actually believing in it. It's sort of like when you go to a football game and cheer, do you actually really believe that your team represents you, that this is some part of your identity? Not really. It's just we like to cheer. We like to get involved. We like the drama. And this is something that I think happens in, this is something that nationalists and populists take advantage of. So I would say this objection that, you know, Putin and the Kremlin hierarchs don't actually believe this ideology that's issuing from their TV broadcasts. You know, that's certainly true. Putin is undoubtedly a pragmatist. Putin has probably very little use for ideology. What I would draw your attention to, though, is how the definition of pragmatism has changed over the last 10 years, since I've been sort of paying attention to Russia over the last 10 to 15 years. The definition of pragmatism, I remember, I mean, let's take the Orange Revolution in Ukraine in 2004, 2005. The definition of pragmatism then was bluster impotently about change of regime about a coup d'etat in Ukraine, but you really actually worried about economic growth, about protecting relationships with trading partners, protecting relationships with Western creditors. You're more concerned about percentage points of GDP growth than you are about territory, about national prestige. Now, fast forward a decade later, the definition of pragmatism is no longer you're willing to sacrifice, you know, billions of dollars in sanctions hit revenues and huge chunks of GDP growth and relationships with all of your major trading partners in exchange for a few kilometers of territory. Russia's interests are suddenly being denominated in territory. The playing field for Putin to be a pragmatist on has changed utterly. Putin is still an incredibly skilled political tactician. He is still an incredibly skilled politician. He is a pragmatist. He is concerned about his own power. But the playing field that he is playing on, the context of being Putin, has changed 180 degrees. So that is the context that I'm talking about. That is what concerns me. I think we're focusing on the wrong thing if we're focusing on Putin. I think we should be focusing on the context, the social context, the cultural context, and that is why I focus on newspaper columnists and TV broadcasts and the postmodern paraphernalia of Russia and the region. Now, if I have a few more minutes, actually, I can handle the rest of it in questions or something. I would just argue that there is a particular theory of nationalism that I believe that has become the focus of the Russian elite. That theory is called Eurasianism. This is a very, very minority view. It's basically me and a few lunatic nationalists who think this. But it's mentioned in speeches, and also I believe the behavior of the Kremlin in politics shows us a lot about what their priorities are. If you were to list a series, if you read the books about Eurasianism, in particular my book, you might not be surprised by what the Kremlin does, and you would not have been surprised by a certain number of things that the Kremlin has done in the recent past, which is a revival of the Orthodox Church, pursuit of something called the Church-State Symphony. However, stopping short of making Orthodoxy a state religion, Russia is not going to be the third Rome in the rhetoric of nationalists. It would explain the decision to fight for Ossetia in Georgia. It would be explain the decision to fight for Ukraine. It would also explain the decision to allow the Baltic states to go and join NATO. That the line, the red line that Russia has apparently drawn around itself, passes through a very specific set of locations. And if you read these guys, you will see where that line goes. Anyway, I'll stop there. I'm not saying that Putin or the Kremlin elite necessarily believe in this theory. I would simply regard what I've been talking about the decision making in the Kremlin and the writings of these nationalists that I'm referring to as a sort of an odd coincidence. I would say definitely in deference to Ambassador Brenton that what we are talking about is the context of being Putin, the context of Russia changing utterly. If Putin were to leave the scene, we would almost certainly have somebody very similar. And so, indeed, be careful what you wish for. Thank you.